Storylines Midwest is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and Barnes & Noble Booksellers.
It's Chicago, the 1930s. A young man, born in poverty, he's living the American dream.
Using his intelligence and ingenuity, he can become whatever he wants to be. The problem is, he has to decide just what that is. From Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Storylines Midwest. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Keith Taylor. Today, the adventures of Augie March, Depression-era Chicago, and the life of Saul Bellow.
And we'd like to hear from you with your stories and your questions. 866-255-2762. The number to call, 866-255-2762. It's Storylines Midwest. Saul Bellow grew up in Quebec and Chicago. He lived and wrote through the Depression, World War II, the Vietnam War, and he is still living and writing. He's married for the fifth time. He has a very young daughter, and last year he published his latest novel, Ravelstein, and his collected short stories have just been released. He's won almost every prestigious award an author can win, the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, three times, and in 1976, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's also had a number of bestsellers, including The Adventures of Augie March.
The Adventures of Augie March is not like other novels. It is hard to pick out a plot from this big book and say, see, this is the story. British novelist Martin Amis, who considers Augie March to be the great American novel of the 20th century, says, Augie March often resembles a surrealist catalog of apprenticeships. Augie tries on 50 different jobs, some legal, some a bit more marginal, trying to find the one that suits him. But always there is the complete sense of confidence that Augie shows right in the first sentence.
I am an American, Chicago born, Chicago, that somber city, and go at things as I have taught myself freestyle, and will make the record in my own way, first to knock, first admitted. Sometimes an innocent knock, sometimes a not-so-innocent. But a man's character is his fate, says Heraclitus, and in the end there isn't any way to disguise the nature of the knocks by acoustical work on the door or gloving the knuckles. Everybody knows there is no fineness or accuracy of suppression. If you hold down one thing, you hold down the adjoining.
Augie's fate is to wander around Chicago, trying to figure out who he is and what he should do. He never seems to feel lost. He enjoys himself. His sheer exuberance for living is the reason this book was a bestseller in the 1950s, and it's what keeps bringing people back.
About a generation after Saul Bellow, James Atlas grew up in Chicago, also a part of the Chicago Jewish community. He is highly respected for his biography, Delmore Schwartz, The Life of an American Poet, and his other work. He's the founding editor of the Lipper Viking Penguin Live series, a series of short biographies of major historical and religious figures. Just last year, he published Bellow, a biography. In the introduction to Bellow, James Atlas writes that a major biography takes 10 years to write. We had an opportunity to speak with him recently, and I asked him what it was that made him decide to commit such a significant part of his life to documenting Saul Bellow's life.
I suppose I, on a very basic level, identified with him, and I was very excited by the fact that he had written about a world that was, in essence, my world a generation earlier. So there was a very strong autobiographical association that I had. Also, I'd been reading his work for many years and admiring it. And my first biography of Delmore Schwartz was intertwined in a very interesting and complex way with Bellow's own life, because they had been friends in the 1940s, and Bellow then, several decades later, wrote Humboldt's Gift, which was really modeled on Delmore's life. So in effect, this was a continuation of the story that I told in my first biography. And finally, I was very excited by the way in which Bellow's life really recapitulated the themes and history and major episodes of the entire 20th century. It was really a way of writing what Bellow's friend Rosenfeld, Isaac Rosenfeld, called social history. So there are a lot of motives.
When you say autobiographical, is that simply Chicago, or is there more than just the relationship to the city?
Well, I don't have five wives, but that's a very good question. It's Chicago, and it's also the idea of Bellow's vocation that excited me. Here was somebody who not only wrote about the city, which many great writers had written about before, among them Theodore Dreiser and Upton Sinclair, but he kind of dramatized the whole effort to become a writer. This is what I found really vivifying, was that he was struggling to find his identity through his work, struggling to find his voice. And this effort to become an American writer out of that background, out of that Midwestern world, which was so far from Europe and so far from what one would imagine were the centers of a vibrant literary culture, that I was impressed with it as a model.
Had you met Saul Bellow before you decided to write this book?
I had met him, not in any sustained way, but I went out to interview him in Chicago in the mid-70s when I was writing my biography of Delmore. And then I found myself in a cameo role in Humboldt's Gift, a paragraph on about page 10, where he describes the young biographer flying into Chicago to interview him about the poet Humboldt and, as he put it, fabricating cultural, social, textile rainbows. So it was this kind of satire. You have to be careful around him. He's a right. dangerous guy with a pen. But I knew him just in that way. But I also was very familiar with his family and with his background. You have to understand that the Chicago Jewish community in Chicago is a very small cohort. And Bellow used to describe himself as an anthropologist. He actually studied anthropology at Northwestern in the 30s. And it's a wonderful metaphor for what the writer does, that he's going to study his own tribe. And I myself, I guess, was transfixed by this tribe of Chicago Jews. I mean, to be specific about it, I'm myself from Evanston. I'm from the comfortable suburbs and grew up in the 60s. And so I was fascinated by the example of this earlier generation who had, he was exactly the age of my father and mother, and in fact went to Northwestern with them. And so I knew people in his world. And I wanted, in the spirit of an anthropologist, to go back and study my tribe and its antecedents.
That would certainly explain Bellow's appeal to you. But then we take a look at some of these books, and we've seen them, and they've been enormous bestsellers. They've reached out to a very broad community, much more than the North Side Chicago Jewish milieu, for instance, that you read about.
Yeah.
How would you? What's the appeal of Bellow's books to this larger audience?
Well, I think what was so exciting to me was precisely the fact that he did escape from this rather narrow, though very rich, Chicago world and speak to a very large audience. I mean, he did, as I mentioned before, have this close friend, Isaac Rosenfeld, who also aspired to be a writer and, in fact, wrote a novel about Chicago that was published in the 1940s. And he didn't have the reach, he didn't have the range and voice that Bellow had. Obviously, the reason that Bellow won the Nobel Prize and is read all over the world is that he deals with universal themes. He's really a fantastically rich novelist in his ability to capture not only states of mind, but periods in history. Starting with his first book, Dangling Man, that was a book that would seem to be very narrow in its themes. It was about Chicago Jewish intellectuals and Hyde Park in the 1940s. But it deals with the whole sense of anxiety about the war, about the impending war, and what would happen to the world in its aftermath. It's really about questions of identity and the individual in relation to huge historical developments over which we have no control. And in this sense, he's universal. And all of his books can be, you can find these major themes in his work. That's why he's a major novelist.
Do you think that his early work is still relevant to people today?
I think his first two books, which are not read perhaps as much as some of his later books like Herzog, Dangling Man and The Victim, are really among his greatest works. They're very European in their tone and texture. He really captured in those early books a sense of anxiety that would become pervasive. I've already said something about Dangling Man, but The Victim is a book that's really very much, it's written right after World War II, and it's about the Holocaust, really, and about, although it doesn't really mention it in any direct way, about the sense of anxiety produced by this event. What are humans capable of? How can we bear witness? What is our responsibility? As he says at the end of that novel, a character asks the protagonist, who really runs things? That's what he wants to know. He's really interested in the largest themes of power and the role of the individual in history. And yet he's not abstract. You know, I mentioned these themes, but they're all played out in this wonderful story about people embedded in the texture of their own lives. And so they're not abstract at all.
And then we get to Augie March, which is his third book, or third novel. And you look at it, and it's a very different book. It's much bigger. It sprawls across pages and pages and pages. If you look for a plot, sometimes it's hard to find it. But yet that is, I mean, I think it's pretty clear from your biography, that was his breakout book. That was the book that got him the big audience. How do you explain how do you explain that appeal of Augie? I mean, it seems so daunting in the abstract, but yet the book
The book was a huge success. You're right about plot, by the way. I mean, plot has never been Bellow's strong suit. He's not a great storyteller in that sense. He's a great ruminator. He likes to deal with large themes, and his characters are always walking around meditating on what he likes to call the big issues. But with that novel, his first two novels sold very modestly, and he had, after them, acquired a reputation among New York intellectuals. But Augie, which came out in 1953 when he was 38, was indeed his breakout book, and it appeared on the bestseller list. This was a book that he had a really hard time writing. He went to Paris on a Guggenheim Fellowship after the war, and he was struggling to write a book that he called his hospital novel. It's a very earnest, grim book. I've read a chapter of it about two guys lying in hospital beds talking about the meaning of the universe. But he was in despair over this book, it wasn't until he left Chicago and was in Paris that he finally found his theme. Now, Augie, as plotless as it is a fantastic book because it's really, I think it's, and so do other writers and critics like Martin Amis, think it's the great American novel, certainly of the 20th century, in the sense that Augie is, as he says in the opening sentence, I'm an American, Chicago-born, first to knock, first to enter, and I will make the record as I see fit. Mm-hmm. So that in this very first, in the opening of the book, he's declaring his independence from other people's expectations. Now, I think that's a great theme right there. And when you combine that with his American journey and his struggle to find out who he really is in life, it's not a Jewish book, certainly. I mean, none of his books are Jewish books in that sense. But it's a book about finding your way in life, finding out who you are. What could be more appealing and universal than that?
I want to talk to you about the writing style that Saul Bellow used. It's been noted that it was a major departure from what other writers of his time were doing, and the sentences are long and sprawling sometimes. Can you tell us what Saul Bellow was rebelling against?
He said that his first books, he liked to refer to them as his MA and his PhD. To my mind, that's an underestimation, a comic underestimation of those books, which remind me of Dostoevsky. And they in themselves they're not dutiful and earnest, but they do have a kind of moral patina about them. They're narrow and confined, and the writing is spare and unadorned. And with Augie, he has this fantastic breakout where, as he liked to describe it, He was walking down the street in Paris one day, and he saw water running down along the curb. You know how when they wash the streets there, the water courses like in rivulets through the gutters. And maybe he was just being fanciful and mythifying his breakthrough. But he said when he saw that rivulet, he realized that was his style, that he wanted freedom. He wanted freedom to write in his own voice, which was full of these jazzy rhythms and borrowed as much from Swift and Fielding as from the more narrow constraints of the 19th century novels of, say, like Dostoevsky's The Dead. He really wanted to break out and write in his own way. And when he realized that he didn't have to be literary, as it were, when whatever he decided was literary, that's when he found his freedom. So the book is great. He said later on that it was too sprawling, too exuberant, but that's part of its charm.
You're listening to Storylines Midwest. Our guest today is James Atlas, author of Bellow, a biography. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Keith Taylor. Now, you're from Chicago, and Bellow will always be associated from Chicago, whether he wants to be or not, and I think he wants to be. Is it fair for us to characterize him as a Midwestern writer? And if it is, what would that mean to you?
He liked to identify himself as, first of all, you're right. He was very proud of Chicago. He had a real love affair with that city. And if you look at his biography, he was always coming back to the city. It was mm-hmm. a place that really appealed to him and that he felt very much at home in, more than in the East. But he liked to say that he was a writer, an American, and a Jew. I mean, it was very important for him not to have other identities. So if, for example, when he won the Nobel Prize, somebody said to him, did you win it for being a Jewish writer? And he said, I believe I won it for being a writer. So he's very wary of any identification of him. He's very wary of any effort to be pinned down. If you were to say, are you a Midwestern writer? He would say, I'm a writer from the Midwest. I happen to also love being from Chicago. I have take tremendous pride in it. And there's even a theory, which I quote in my book, by Milton Friedman, the economist from the University of Chicago, who also won a Nobel Prize, about how Chicago, because of its geographic distance from New York, was in a way more independent from the European influence and was able to establish its own freedom and independence. And I think one of the great things about the city, if one can, and about the Midwest in general, if one can generalize in this way, is that it tends to produce a very hardy, an individual, a hardy strain of individualism and independence. And I really see that in other Chicagoans I know. Like, you know, we just don't buy into it, basically. And I admire that.
I want to talk for just a moment about Saul Bellow as a human being. I mean, you worked with him during the writing of this book. What was your working relationship with him like?
It was a really complicated relationship. I've written about it some, and I hope to write about it again. I'm meditating writing an essay called The Shadow in the Garden about this whole experience of being a biographer, which was just unbelievably complicated because I was there to be his biographer, not his friend. And we had what you might call a business-like relationship, not uncordial, but I would come into Chicago periodically, 3 or 4 times a year, and set up an interview with him. And once in a while, he took me for a drive once to his old neighborhood. I also saw him in the summers in Vermont because we had homes near each other. And summer was kind of time off, time out. I would go over there and just visit. But, of course, I was always taking notes and asking questions. And the book was not authorized. That was very important to me and to him. I didn't want to write his official biography. On the other hand, I was working with him. So he liked to describe it as neither authorized nor unauthorized. But in the end, I did have a relationship with him, and I wrote the book that I wanted to write. With, again, very complicated results. And he was in many ways charming, in many ways difficult. We had our ups and downs and a few storms down along the way. But I have to give him credit. He really let me do this book. And in the end, I'm sure he didn't care for it too much. But it's a very honest portrait. And it's Bello as I see him.
Mm-hmm. When think about the Bello that you thought about when you started writing the book, and then through the many years that you worked on the book and got to know him, how did he change in your mind?
That's a really difficult question to answer. One problem I had was that as I got to know him better, he became less the great novelist and more a person like everyone else. And this obviously influenced my book. There were things he did that I didn't write about in my book that annoyed me, the misrepresentations of things I said, or he would write accounts in print of episodes that just weren't the case, or he would make veiled attacks on me once or twice without really being direct about it and saying what was up. So these were problems, and then I had to deal with my own feelings about him. It was unbelievably hard to do because obviously I suffered a certain amount of disillusionment about his character. At the end, my estimation of his work, if I have to summarize, my estimation of his work went up. I mean, I think Ravelstein is an unbelievable book for him to write at any time, much less in his mid-80s. My estimation of him as a person, I don't know if I would say it went down, but it became more clear-eyed in the way that anyone's relationship becomes. You learn more about them, their human failings become more evident. Now, if you go and write about this and other people don't know about those failings, they're going to resent you for doing it. So it was pretty tough in that way. But I in the end, still felt great sympathy for him. And just to summarize, I was never bored. I mean, I think that's pretty amazing. That's great. Interested me all the way through. And one or two critics who said, well, by the end, Atlas is fed up. I don't know. I was probably fed up with certain things. But I loved writing at every step of the way.
The Schwartz biography, which is, you know, a brilliant book, too, and it was very important to me when I was a young man. But it's a somber book, and it's a sad story. And the feeling at the end of this is, for somebody who wanted to be a young writer anyway, this was a scary thing. The Bello book, on the other hand, feels, much like Augie feels. It feels like an exuberant biography at the end. I still even get that feeling at the end of the book, that it feels so exuberant.
Well, I'm really so delighted to hear you say that. I must say, that's terrific if that's true, because the Delmore book, I felt the same way, even though I wrote it, that you did. I decided I didn't want to be a poet after that. I used to be a poet when I started out, and I thought, I don't have the stomach for this, probably also not the talent, but, you know, it was a somber book, as you say, and a somber story. With Bello, the challenge was, you can't write a book that's too happy. It can't have this Horatio Alger feel. Yeah. Boy from the slums of Chicago wins Nobel Prize. That was difficult for me. I mean, life isn't like that except for one guy. But he's funny. He has a sense of humor, and he has had much pain in his life and much suffering, most of it caused by himself. But he also, I think, does feel in a way that he's got a very rich life. As he said at the end, I didn't quote this. He said it, I think, after my book came out. He said, I've had a rich feast at life's banquet. And then he says, and maybe I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact words. Maybe I hog too much of it or something. Maybe I was gluttonous. And, you know, you do get that feel that he's lived to the hilt.
Well, James Atlas, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
James Atlas is the author of Bello, a Biography. You're listening to Storylines Midwest.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-255-2762. The number is 866-255-2762.
In The Adventures of Augie March, Augie has a faith in the real world, and he thinks it's his responsibility to find his place in it. Here's Daniel Pinkwater reading another passage from Bellow's novel.
Everyone tries to create a world he can live in, and what he can't use, he often can't see. But the real world is already created, and if your fabrication doesn't correspond, then even if you feel noble and insist on there being something better than what people call reality, that better something needn't try to exceed what in its actuality, since we know it so little, may be very surprising. If a happy state of things, surprising, if miserable or tragic, no worse than what we invent.
You're listening to Storylines Midwest. I'm Charity Nebbe. Saul Bellow and his character Augie March grew up in the same neighborhood in Chicago, and we've asked Irving Cutler, the author of The Jews of Chicago, to join us briefly to tell us about that neighborhood. Irving, in the 1920s and 30s, what was that Wicker Park area like?
Well, the Wicker Park area goes back to the late 1800s, when some wealthy non-WASP, Poles, Scandinavians, some Italians, some Jews, moved into the area because they weren't accepted by the very rich people who lived along the lake. They were businessmen, bankers, and they built some very nice homes on a few of the streets in the Wicker Park area.
Now, in the 30s, it was kind of a bastion of Jewish intellectuals in Chicago, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a Jewish presence in the area. They lived among the Poles and the Scandinavians and others. And among those that I could think of that lived there, well, Saul Bellow, Nelson Algren, who is half Jewish, I understand, his father was Jewish, he lived in the area and wrote about the area quite extensively. Michael Todd, you know, the movie impresario, one of the husbands of Elizabeth Taylor, he came from the area. And there were a couple of Jewish families who started out in the Wicker Park area and made it big to the extent that they're exceedingly rich. And they're well-known in the Chicago area. Actually, they're probably well-known nationally. One family are the Pritzkers, or the owner of the Hyatt Regency Hotels and many other things. And the other is Henry Crown, and he was owner of railways and I think part owner of General Dynamics and other companies.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me tonight.
Okay.
Irving Cutler, the author of Jews of Chicago. In the next half hour of the program, we'll continue our discussion about the adventures of Augie March, and we'll be taking your calls and your questions about the book and, of course, about Saul Bellow as well at 866-255-2762. For more information on Storylines Midwest or the books we're reading, you can visit our website at storylines.ala.org or check out your local public library. Libraries have copies of the books, program schedules, and our discussion guides. You're listening to Storylines Midwest.
Storylines Midwest is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and Barnes & Noble Booksellers.